Check, check. Okay, cool.
So to begin, could you just kind of discuss how long has this group been meeting? How did it start? Has it always been associated with the Soto Zen school, etc.?
Y'all go ahead and take that.
Go ahead, because I don't know.
There pre-existed a Buddhist group. They met on the west side of town. They didn't have a dedicated room like we did. I don't know when it was formed. I'm going to say probably early 90s. And I know at one time they were followed the Korean Zen tradition, which still relied a lot on sitting. Then that went on for a while. Then Catherine had joined the group, and she had a Soto Zen background of the same we did. And that group kind of, it didn't dissolve, it just kind of transformed into Soto Zen and started calling itself Southwind Sangha Soto Zen. I don't think they used the word center at that time. I think they just called it Southwind Sangha. Later on, we incorporated. That was within the last 10 or 12 years. So we're a 501c organization now, nonprofit under IRS. Then it's been that. We've had several locations. We've been in a Unitarian church, an old one. We've been in a newer Unitarian church. They just built a new one and moved, and then we've been at our present location, which you sat in, the place at near Hillside, near the university. That's kind of the history. The group has always been pretty small. We've had at retreats, we've had attendance up to 15 or so. On these Saturday retreats, it's frequently between 5 and 8. It does go up to 10 or 12 sometimes. Then our regular services that aren't retreats are just hour-long services, kind of a typically 3 to 6 people.
Okay.
So it's a small group. And that's kind of the history. Let's see, you asked about more than just history.
So you're also an affiliate of the center in Atlanta?
Yes.
Is that correct? Is there a whole lot of interaction between this organization and the larger one, and does that like affect any of the practices on the local level?
Yeah, I'll let Liz talk about the discussion group, which she mentioned in her talk. We started out as just an affiliate of Atlanta almost right away, because Catherine had been in Atlanta, my wife, and had a connection with the teacher there, Michael Elliston, who's a Japanese Dharma name, is Taiyun, Zinke Taiyun. As an affiliate, we kind of need a transmitted teacher. He's a transmitted teacher, what some people call Zen master, although they're not necessarily always the same. He had training under a couple of different schools, plus the original guy, Matsuoka Roshi, was mentioned in the talk. There's also what's called a Silent Thunder Order, which is made up roughly of representatives from the different sanghas. There varies between 8 or 9 and 12 or 13 sanghas. They're all over the country and even in Canada. Silent Thunder Order is just kind of a thing that was started about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's also 501c, and so is Atlanta 501c, as kind of a support organization. Sensei in Atlanta just got kind of tired of making every decision, administrative, substantive, teaching, and everything else, so he wanted some priests and disciples to kind of support his decisions, and especially administrative decisions rather than spiritual.
Okay.
But also we have a Thai that Liz can talk about with this discussion group, which is really important, and some other things like internet. You might just talk about all the rest of that.
The Silent Thunder Order tried, because it's not a place. I mean, it's kind of housed at Atlanta Soto Zen Center, but it's really the umbrella organization for all these different sanghas, and then they're just more, I wouldn't say internet-based, but we try to have activities. It's a silent, the discussion group is really from Silent Thunder, but anybody can participate. You don't have to be part of the group. And that would be something that the Silent Thunder Order does, that provides support to individuals. And Sensei's idea is, like, I'm in Ness City, Kansas, and there's really not a whole lot going on. There's actually some people who would subscribe to Buddhism, but the idea of, I mean, it's just too foreign to all get together as a group, you know, to do that. So everybody just meditates on their own. Or the people who do that. But so for people who want to practice that don't have a real strong sangha close to them, then it gives them an opportunity to participate. So I drive into Wichita just once a month, is all I'm here. But weekly, I have a connection with the Skype sessions and that sort of thing. And so, like, the board meets through Skype. I think on the board there's people from Nova Scotia, Montana, Kansas, Nashville,
Massachusetts.
I mean, so it's just, and everybody has had a connection with Sensei in some form or another. You know, the Massachusetts used to live in Atlanta. Sensei was his teacher, and he moved, so he started the sangha there. Same thing with Nova Scotia, Florida, here. So that's how it works with the Silent Thunder Order.
You could get a lot of information if you want even more detail. Silent Thunder Order has a very active website.
Okay.
It's more involved than ours. It has audio of some of the discussions, a lot about our structures and things like that. Liz is very active in communication and the Dharma discussion. She kind of helps plan what the topics are.
There's like a newsletter that goes out monthly.
Cool.
She's a giant of the silent thing.
That's a secretary where you got a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah. So to take it a step down, I guess, to more like individual practice, did either of you before, have experience in other forms of Buddhism? Was it always, did you kind of just discover Zen or what spoke to you about Zen specifically, I guess?
Well, for me, I was probably what would be considered a book Buddhist, which I read, because there's really no... I actually called the place in Garden City, which may be the same place you went to, mm-hmm. and they spoke Vietnamese.
It was the same place.
and it was, call back. So I called back when an English-speaking person was there who said, told me about the life of Buddha, then hung up. So I think that's all he could say in English. He could say anything else. So I was like, well, there's no place to practice. So I just read Tricycle Magazine from front to cover, books, that sort of thing. And then I found out about the Wichita group actually in the Tricycle Magazine. Came, didn't really start then, but then just, I looked at all the groups. I looked at the one in Kansas City, the one in Lawrence, and just decided that Wichita would be the easiest to get to. Mm-hmm. So they were Soto Zen, and that's what I did.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a very good match, but I didn't choose Zen. Zen chose me.
No.
Would be what it was. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Sure.
Yeah, I've... childhood was Christian. I've been a Christian, an atheist, just maybe a spiritual path. I felt like I needed something organized at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, and my daughter sent me a book on comparative religion. So I read through it, read about the Judaism and Hindus and, you know, various religions, Muslim. And when I read Buddhism, boy, that really just rang a bell with me. So I immediately happened to find in the newspaper that they were going to give meditation lessons, or the typical Wednesday, first Wednesday of the month instruction. Went to it. I thought it would be more teaching, you know, and then exactly what you went through this morning was what I went through, and I thought, well, this more is like a yoga class or something, and I didn't come back for about 6 months. I think, actually, Liz and I got participatory about the same time, and I finally went back and heard a few talks, went to a few retreats, realized that reading was encouraged, and there were discussions, but they were just kind of below the radar unless you went a little bit. So, and then I started going to Atlanta for some longer term retreats. They have long, anywhere from 3 to 9 days, and you can sit 9 hours a day for days at a time, kind of a marathon. But that's how I got into it.
Oh, that's great. Something specific that I noticed this morning was that everybody, when they're meditating, faces the wall. I'm just wondering, why is that? What's the significance of that?
My understanding is it's the withdrawal from sensory. So vision is a strong sensory, so you sit where there's nothing to look at. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there. And so, as in you're even working on your vision of just not really focusing on anything. And if there's something there, then you're going to focus on it. So it's more of a, I think it is significant. I really wouldn't be able to explain why it's significant, other than to facilitate and put you more in that Joseph Campbell. He had said that the function of the churches and the temples and all that is to take you out of society and take you into a realm that is not the ordinary. I don't think necessarily that's exactly the way it is with Zen, of not the ordinary, because it is, Zen is ordinary. But it is a way of taking you to that center, to your center, and just kind of withdrawing as much as you can. So the stillness, nothing to look at, you don't play any music, you don't purposely put anything there to hear as well. And so it's, you sit facing the wall. I have tried to sit not facing the wall, and it doesn't work very well. You know, when I'm doing Eno, I'm sitting as best I can, but there's stuff there. And you got to watch the clock anyway, so it is there. So it's different than when I'm sitting and I'm facing the wall. That would be the best way I could explain it.
I would just add some things more like footnotes. Rinzai Zen does face the center. They're more intellectual. They actually, when they're sitting, they don't not engage in deliberate thought as much. Another thing is Dogen has this very basic talk that he gave where he said about sitting, he said, find a quiet place, not too warm, not too cold, not too light, not too dark, which is kind of a middle way between everything. So facing the wall is maybe not a middle way, but it I think it's a practice that more has to do with exactly what Liz said, is the less sensory stimulation you have, especially when you're just a beginner. I guess we're always beginners, but I found it a lot easier to have a very sterile atmosphere when I started. I can sit now and look at something that busy and kind of not be affected by it that much. In fact, at first I was sitting in Atlanta one time in front of this curtain that had very few things, but it was, you know, woven. And Sensei grabbed me and moved me where I had nothing but a wall. He knew that that probably isn't going to work out very well.
Sure.
That's all I have to say.
Are there any other... are there any other things about Soto Zen specifically that you think are unique, specifically with the meditation practices, compared to other forms of Zen or Buddhism in general, I guess?
Yeah, I would say Tibetan has three or four forms of meditation. We just have one. They have kind of a concentrated meditation, like where you look at a candle and focus on that. You remember I also said there are even Zen groups that really emphasize the breath a lot more, and you kind of follow the breath through the whole thing. I think the way we differ is the thing is just don't engage in deliberate thought and notice what your mind is, how you really don't have as very much control over it. Can you think of anything else?
I think it's the it's also the emphasis on not getting anywhere. You know, we a lot of times will have a discussion on Monday night with Catherine throwing some things in. And we always end with, well, we didn't get anywhere. There was no conclusion. Perfect discussion.
I love your statement this morning I loved your statement this morning about, I know the answer to this, but I don't know the question. That was
Zen. I think the idea of that you sit, but you really have to drop away all reason for sitting. And if you have a goal, if you have a prize, then you're not sitting zazen. It's that shikantaza, that just doing just to be doing, and that emphasis in that, where some of the other traditions, because I read a lot about Tibetan Buddhism and wanted to be Tibetan Buddhism, except for I'm not in Tibet, although I love their jewelry. I do wear a lot of the jewelry. But there seems to be more of a process or a goal, or, you know, this is how you do the meditation, this is what you do when you're meditating. And in Zazen, it's not so simple to explain to somebody what to do. So, in fact, it said Del, who used to be with the group, and she, I think she still is, she just doesn't sit as much due to health reasons, but when she first started, she said that she was told not to read anything. Just sit. Don't try to figure out what you're doing. Just do it. So that kind of thing.
What do you think?
Before you move on, would you tell him about the sewing practice after he asks that question? Go ahead.
So just to kind of bounce off of that and kind of bring up something that was discussed in your talk today. And it's kind of a big question, perhaps. This idea of just sitting and it being hard to explain.
Uh-huh.
What is the relationship then in your mind between zazen, or, you know, just sitting, and being out in the world and like being and interacting, you know, with people?
I think for me, I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but for me, it's the idea, like for instance, when I first started Zen. One of my very first questions to Sensei during a Dokusan was, what is the Zen way of getting people to do what you want them to do? Can you tell me what is the proper way to just mold people into what I need from them? And so it's a looking out, how do you need to change? How does my husband need to change? how do the people around me need to change? And instead, what the just sit is just bringing it back to you. What do I need to do? So, like when I walk into the classroom, I get up off my cushion and I walk into the classroom, and I know that there are certain elements of effective instruction for kids in wheelchairs that don't talk and don't move very much. I know the effective instruction. The teacher doesn't. I have this knowledge, they don't. how do I get an effective program for that student? Well, I can't walk in, which I have done at one time. I mean, I tried that. It doesn't work. Saying, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this. And when you make it less about you, and you open up, as Harold said, you open up to what are some other possibilities other than that teacher doesn't care about them, obviously, because when I walk in and tell them what the right thing to do is, they would do it. They don't care. They just won't do it. Why am I the only one who cares? You get out of that mode and then can go in and say, okay, what? How do we solve this? What's this problem? What's this problem? What's this problem? You do more listening than you do talking, and you figure out how to make things work. And there are those people out there who are jerks, but they're not really that many people, you know. And sometimes they're a jerk for a reason, you know. I mean, sometimes there's a reason for why they are what they're doing, and you need compassion for that. And that's a very hard thing to do, but I like Harold's statement too, is he actually found himself having compassion for the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
It means your Zen is working. You know, you're not that you don't have compassion for the people who were shot, not at all, but it's just you can see the broader picture.
Mm-hmm.
And you still know, though, even though you have compassion for the shooter, that that's not something you should have done.
Mm-hmm.
So it's being able to handle that. Whereas before, it would be just, if you did something wrong, you know,
mm-hmm.
scratch you off. You're a worthless piece of, you know. So I think... I don't know if
that
answers your question.
Yeah, it does.
Well, with that question, Sensei often uses a metaphor. He says there's a mountain, and you start here, you know, where Liz and I started, and you climb that mountain, and, you know, you read more, study more, sit a long time, and you get to the peak of the mountain, and... This is what Dogen says, rivers and streams aren't rivers and streams anymore. You know, like Liz talked about mountains walking. Your mind is just completely so liberated that, and engaged in abstract thinking at this peak. Well, that's not awakening, really. That's not awakening. Then you begin to come back down the mountain and begin more and more applying, you know, Zazen and the teachings to your everyday life. You begin to live it instead of study it until you get down here, and we call that the marketplace. Then you go out in the marketplace and no one would even know you're a Buddhist. It's just you act a certain way, you're mindful. There's even some pictures. It's called the Oxford pictures, and the last picture is this guy just kind of with his arms hanging at his side walking around. So the real goal is awakening, which is not this great high spiritual state. It's being in reality. That's the highest, to be engaged in reality without any colored glasses or prejudice, bias, predispositions, is that's a way. So that's what we go for, is we don't really carry things that we've learned out into the marketplace life. We just live life.
Great.
That's something like maybe points at what we do.
Sure.
What we try to do. What I try to do.
Yeah. What was the metaphor you were?
The metaphor is the mount.
The one
the
you were.
Oxfording?
There's Oxfording pictures.
Yeah. That you asked her to discuss.
Oh, sewing. Well, that
sewing.
Goes back
sewing.
To the original
sewing
question
practice.
About how
oh.
we're different.
Oh yeah. Well, another thing that would be different is there's the sewing tradition, and Dogen brought that to Japan, and then it has been carried on here, and it was almost lost, but of sewing your robe. So I didn't bring my vestment in, but I sewed the rakusu that I had on, and then you become an ordained priest, then you sew your robe, and you sew your bowing mat, your zagu, and then transmitted is the same thing. So we do that as part of this Soto Zen group, and I think a lot of Soto Zen groups do that, but it's called sewing practice, and it's a certain, I think it's the Minnesota site. Yeah, I think it's Minnesota. I can send you the link of because it's a certain, you sew the robe in a certain way, okay. And you do it by hand. It's all by hand, it's kind of a, I hate to use the word mindfulness, but it's kind of a emotion in stillness thing. So the sitting is you're still, but there's a lot going on too. I think one of my favorite things that I learned from Zenku was Matsuroka's statement of somebody asking, how do you know when you're doing Soto Zen? It's a sitting mountain feeling. So thinking that it's a real, it's an active thing, even though you're very still. So the motion and stillness, as well as the stillness and motion. So for me, that sewing practice is the stillness and motion. And I do sewing when somebody needs something, so I volunteer to do that. And there are, I don't know who all is a certified sewing teacher, but we work with Karen, a woman from Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
So that would be another thing, I forgot about that, but that'd be another thing that Soto Zen, and in particular STU does.
Great.
Yeah, the robes are that we sewed, Liz and I, are 7-panel robes. And I don't know how long it took Liz, but it took me Saturday afternoons, about 3 hours almost every Saturday afternoon for about a year.
Really?
Because there, you have to go around it several times, and there's a certain stitch that you use. It's not a real fancy stitch. It's, in fact, probably pretty simple. But and actually, with each stitch, you're supposed to say homage to Buddha. Homage to Buddha. Of course, they're not that fast, and you usually screw up and have to tear out a whole line of stitching. It's also a patience practice, yeah, as well as mindfulness, because you are going to screw up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really frustrating, because you maybe have an hour or two in this, and all of a sudden, it didn't work for some reason.
Wow. So I only have a couple more questions.
Sure.
And they're kind of about the local community, I guess. So is there any interaction between Southwind and other local Buddhist organizations?
No.
No?
Well, I've gone to Sunflower, which is a Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't know whether you've heard of Thich Nhat Hanh or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of their focus, is on his teachings. And I've gone to, there's a Pho Phat temple, Vietnamese. I've gone there several times for their services. Also, they brought
the Jade Buddha.
Jade Buddha, which is an 8-foot-tall Buddha made of jade that was brought in from some Southeast Asian country.
Yeah.
Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam. And we have had, you know, I say no, and then that's really not true. There's a bunch of Thai monks. The Thai monks are in a totally different Theravada. You know, we're Mahayana and they're Theravada. Couldn't be different. They just have monks, and the lay people don't pay a whole lot of attention, and you really can't get awakened unless you're a monk. You really don't sit or do anything unless you're a monk. But they wanted to, there's a book called What the Buddha Taught, and he wanted his young monks from Thailand, the leader over there, wanted them to know how to speak English better. You know, they knew how to read it and everything, so Catherine read the whole book in English. Gave them the tape. Yeah, and so that they could hear her speak the words, and then they could kind of practice doing them. Then we had one of the young Thai monks come and sit with us. So There's not a lot of interaction, I can't say. There's not like a big interfaith umbrella group in Wichita, but I don't... Each group's pretty isolated, other than those incidental contacts.
Okay. What about the, like, the, I guess, non-Buddhist religious groups? Is there any contact there, like, you know, Christian groups, for instance? I know there's a church right across the street from where you guys practice.
Yeah, they own that building.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't interact. Now, I've gone to a couple of different churches and told them about Zazen and a little bit about Buddhism. Some of the colleges are private Christian colleges that come and visit us.
Oh, okay.
There's not a lot of interfaith. Well, we did send a... Dell was sent as a delegate to the Interfaith Ministries.
Okay.
And she went to some dinners and things like that. So, and I don't know what they do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some interaction with a Hindu group, too. Have some friends that are Hindus, which is a little bit similar to Buddhism.
Sure.
There's some similarities, and they'd let me go, and I'd chant some of my chants, and they'd sing, oh, beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have much of a music tradition in Zen.
I think when we were at the Unitarian, Dell was a Unitarian, so there would be a little bit of connection there, but since we don't go there anymore, since we don't practice there, that really isn't there anymore. But while we were there, do some things. There would be some activities that when Sensei would come in, he'd give a public talk, and it would be at the Unitarian Church, and they would help advertise it and things like that. So, but we don't do that with the church we're at now that I'm aware of. But so at that time.
In fact, their minister,
that was about all I can think of.
Their minister was Hindu at this Unitarian Church.
Oh, really?
And one time Sensei and him gave a joint talk when mm-hmm. Sensei was in town for a retreat.
Okay. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So
kind of comparing their religions. And so.
Last question.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of simple, vague, and open-ended, but it kind of gets, like, I guess, the theme of my project in general and gives
mm-hmm.
you a chance to sound off.
Sure.
So, what's it like being a Buddhist in Kansas?
Tell him about the... You ought to tell him about the concealed carry.
Well, in my neck of the woods, lonely. I think that, the people who know me and know I practice and am a practicing Buddhist, they're very accepting, I would say. I did visit a couple of times with a minister from one of the local churches, but most of the churches are too conservative to allow any kind of a Buddhist thing. Because I tried to get like a meditation session there, saying it won't be anything about Buddhism; it'll just be, you know, we just go and meditate. And the minister was open to it, but for some reason, I don't know why, it just never worked. So I would say that for the most part, if you don't know me very well, I mean, I don't tell you that I'm a Buddhist, but anybody who is close enough that something may come up, like, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, it's my... retreat to Wichita. In fact, we have some good friends who are Christian, and they know every third Saturday we're not around. So even a couple of weeks ago, the wife, who you may not think would be all that open at one time, she probably would not have been, but she was like, now I know next weekend you are do your Buddhist thing, so we can't meet then, so we'll have to do it, you know. I mean, very open. So, I would say lonely, but maybe perhaps that's not it. Just a, it's a tough question. I really wouldn't know how to answer that other than, it's works for me.
Yeah. care enough?
I don't get to. Probably get more ref from my mother than anybody else. Yeah. She's not pleased by it. But. Sure.
Yeah, I would say I have a lawyer I office with. He actually is the landlord, and we all three of us independently office there. And he is a fundamental Christian. And it came out. I too don't tell people I'm a Buddhist. If they ask, I'll answer honestly. If they say, "What's your religion?" I'll answer honestly. But you have to be really close to me before I will volunteer. You know, volunteered, I probably haven't volunteered it to outside this group of, you know, half a dozen people. Although a lot more know that. But I'd say he wants to convert me. I mean, he this was his statement. He said, "Don, when I go to heaven, I want to see you there to greet me. I'm a lot older than he is." So it runs the gamut from wanting to convert me to Christianity to indifference to that's interesting, you know. But usually people don't want to know much about it. They just say it's kind of interesting. They wonder, a lot of times they'll ask some of the questions you did. Why? How did you become a Buddhist? You know, you're Caucasian. Don't talk funny. being a Buddhist in Kansas, probably our political bent is way out of kilter with the politics of most Kansans. We tend to be, I think the tendency is for at least the Buddhists I've been around, to be somewhat liberal. Well, you know Kansas, so I will have to tell you how that works.
Indeed.
But so we don't fit in very well politically. And maybe even culturally. Being a Buddhist in Kansas is probably pretty much staying under the radar as much as anything, because it makes people, like in an interview, a job interview, I would never say I'm a Buddhist. Fortunately, they can't ask you questions about religion because of some of the federal acts, but I would imagine 75% of the employers wouldn't hire you because they think you're all. That's probably true, not just in Kansas. I'd say the percentage would go up and down, but that's... Mm-hmm. If I were a Buddhist, I don't think I'd go anywhere in the country except maybe San Francisco and openly say I was a Buddhist to a potential employer.
Well, I think as you were talking, I thought, you know, on the one hand, it actually has... being a Buddhist in a place where there aren't a lot, then... I mean, I really had to question, is that really what I want? I mean, is that really the path I want to go on?
Okay, yeah.
And because of the tension with my mother, not necessarily my family members, but with my mother, not that, I mean, she is one of my family members, but I mean my siblings, it has been, I don't want to cause her grief, and this certainly does cause her grief, so... Am I sure this is what the path that I should be on? Am I sure? Because I don't want to go on a path and cause grief for no reason, just to be my usual self with her.
You're not sure either, are you?
No, I am. And then in Ness City, being, you know, it's 3 hours by car here, and so you really have to be committed to it. I mean, you know, so it's deep in the practice, and then I have to have a home practice because I only do it once. So it's really actually, I don't know if my practice would be where it is now if I were in a place where the availability or there was more support around me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had to seek it, and I've had to do it, and like the Skype sessions, that's one of the reasons. I hardly ever miss a Skype session, and that's one of the reasons, because I don't have the opportunity there much. So the opportunities that are there, I make sure I do.
Yeah.
So I would say, it occurred to me that as you were talking, I thought, well, you know, on the one hand, it's probably a good thing that I'm at least in Kansas, because I don't know if my practice would be as deep as it is if it was more readily available.
Yeah, I didn't think of it from that standpoint. What is it from your standpoint, not at standpoint of others? Yeah, from my standpoint, I would say exactly the same thing. There's such a contrast, it makes me think about it more often. If I were surrounded by Buddhists, I'd probably, it'd be like a fish in water. You wouldn't be aware of the water.
Yeah.
But since we're flopping around on dry land, we're very aware of the water. Interesting.
Well, great.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Don't ever get. You can go off.